gently let go of the day. There is nothing you need to do, nowhere you need to be. Just listen and allow yourself to drift. Tonight, you are going to Austria, not in a hurry, not with a long list of things to accomplish. You are simply going the way you go somewhere in a dream, with a kind of easy forward motion, the world arranging itself around you as you move through it. The place you are going to is a gorge, a narrow, deep, wild gorge carved into the limestone mountains of Tyrol by a small river that has been doing this very patiently for a very long time. It is called the Wolf's Klamm, the Wolf's Gorge, and it is one of those places that once you have been there, you carry with you, not as a memory exactly, more as a feeling, the feeling of being inside the mountain, of being held between stone walls and cool air and running water, while the hot world above you continues on without your participation, and you are simply here, in the cool and the dark and the green. The morning starts in Innsbruck. You are at the main station, Hauptbahnhof, and the day is already warm. The sun comes over the rooftops with an intention that promises real heat by mid-morning, and you can feel it on the back of your neck as you walk along the platform looking for your train. But before you find it, you look up, because in Innsbruck you always look up. The city sits at 574 meters above sea level in a long valley carved by the Inn River, and on its northern side the land simply rises steeply and without much apology into the Nordkette range of the Karwendel Alps. The Nordkette, it is right there, above the rooftops, above the church spires, above the pale facades of the old city, a wall of grey and green mountain rising almost 2,000 metres above the station where you are standing. You stand on the platform and look at it. The peaks are already sharp in the morning light, the upper ridges bright, the forested lower slopes a deep, saturated green that almost hums with colour in the early heat. Innsbruck is known as the capital of the Alps. Standing here, you understand why. There is no distance between the city and the mountains. They are not a backdrop. They are a presence. They are in the city. The way the Inn River is in the city, woven into it, unavoidable and beautiful, and simply there. You find your train. You find your seat by the window. You settle in. The journey from Innsbruck to Stans takes about 30 minutes. 30 quiet, unhurried minutes along the Inn Valley, the river keeping pace beside the tracks, broad and quick, and the colour of deep glacial grey-green, fed by snowmelt from peaks you can only half see behind the nearer ranges. The train moves east. Outside the window, the valley floor passes in a gentle sequence of meadows and orchards and small farmsteads, wooden barns with wide overhanging roofs, their weathered timber the colour of old honey. The mountains rise on either side, closer on the north. The Karwendel slopes descending through forest almost to the valley floor, and further on the south, the broader ridge lines of the Tuxer Alps, blue-grey in the morning haze. You watch all of it. You are not in a hurry. The seat is comfortable. The light through the window is warm without being harsh. Occasionally, a small village slides past, a church, a cluster of houses, a level crossing where a car waits patiently, and then open meadow again, and the river, and the mountains. There is something about travelling by train through alpine valleys that encourages a particular kind of quietness. Not the quietness of nothing happening, but the quietness of watching things happen from a slight remove. As if the window is a frame and the landscape outside it is something being shown to you, slowly and without commentary, for your consideration. You consider it. The river bends south. The valley opens slightly. A heron stands in the shallows near low stone bridge, completely still, watching the water with the total concentration of a creature that has nowhere else to be. You watch the heron for a moment, and then the train moves on, and the heron is behind you and ahead. The valley narrows slightly, and the mountains lean in a little closer, and the sign at the small station reads Stans. Stans is a quiet village. You step off the train into the full warmth of the morning and stand for a moment on the small platform, adjusting to the heat, adjusting to the stillness. After the gentle rhythm of the train, there is a new kind of quiet here, a village quiet. The kind made of bird calls and the sound of a tractor somewhere on the far hillside, and the distant rushing of water that you cannot yet see but can already hear. A low, continuous sound, just at the edge of perception, like something breathing beneath the surface of the morning. That sound is the Stanser Bach, the Stanser Brook, running down from the high mountains, already beginning to make itself known to you before you have even found it. You follow the path from the station through the village. The walk takes about 20 minutes, and you take it slowly because the morning is beautiful and because there is no reason to rush. The path moves through the lower part of the village, past old stone houses with window boxes of red geraniums, past a small parish church whose bell sounds once as you pass it, a single tone that lasts a long time in the warm air, fading gradually rather than stopping, the way bell tones do, dissolving rather than ending. The mountains are close on all sides. To the north, the forested slopes of the Carwendel rise almost directly from the edge of the village, dark green and steep, and somewhere up in those forests the gorge is waiting. The narrow slot in the limestone where the brook has been cutting its path for longer than any human record. The path climbs gradually out of the village, following the brook upstream. The sound of the water growing clearer as you go, shifting from a distant murmur to something more definite, a consistent rushing and tumbling that you begin to feel as well as hear, a low vibration in the ground beneath your feet. The trees thicken, the light changes. Above you, the canopy closes, and the hard sunlight of the valley becomes something dappled and green, broken into fragments by the leaves overhead, shifting as the branches move, making the path ahead of you flicker gently between shadow and light. You can feel the temperature dropping, not dramatically, not suddenly, just a gradual cooling as you move away from the open valley and into the shade of the trees as you move closer to the water. As the stone walls of the gorge begin to rise on either side, and the sky narrows overhead, and the light takes on a new quality, dimmer and cooler and greener. And then you are at the entrance. You stop. You simply stop, and you look. The gorge opens before you like something the mountain has parted deliberately, as if the rock has simply drawn back on either side and revealed this space between this narrow vertical world of stone and water. and shadow. The walls are limestone, ochre and slate, grey, streaked with moisture, hung with ferns and mosses that grow wherever there is the smallest ledge, the smallest perches, reaching out toward the thin strips of light that fall between the cliff tops above. And between the walls, far below the path, the Stanza Brook moves through its narrow bed in a state of continuous agitation. White, where it breaks over the rocks, and between the white, a deep, clear, impossible green, the colour that only fast, cold water over lightstone can make, a colour that does not quite exist in any other context. You breathe in. The air is cold here, genuinely cold, after the warmth of the valley. Not the sharp cold of altitude, but a damp mineral cold, the cold of deep rock and running water, the cold of a place the sun does not fully reach. It carries moisture. A fine mist drifts up from the water below, not heavy enough to see clearly, but enough that your skin feels it. A gentle dampness on your face and arms, a coolness that is entirely welcome after the heat of the walk from the station. And it carries sound. The gorge is full of sound. The water is not quiet here. It moves through a channel that forces it over ledges and between boulders, and the sound it makes is constant and layered, a low roar beneath everything, and within that roar a hundred smaller sounds, the high, clear note of water falling, and the deep, hollow knock of a bigger drop, and the continuous quick murmur of the shallows, and underneath all of it, steady and foundational, the sound of the mountain itself, the sound of water that began as snow on a high ridge and has been moving downward, gathering itself for a very long time. You stand at the entrance for a long moment, letting your eyes adjust to the dimmer light, letting your skin adjust to the cool, letting your ears adjust to the sound, and then slowly you begin. The path is remarkable. In 1901, the first hiking trail was carved through here, and what the builders created is less a path and more a negotiation with the rock, a careful threading of wooden bridges and iron staircases and stretches of walkway, bolted directly to the cliff face, following the only route available, which is always the route the water dictates. You follow it upward. The first bridge is wooden, planks thick and dark with moisture, the handrail worn smooth by the hands of everyone who has come this way. You cross it slowly, pausing in the middle, leaning on the rail and looking down. The water below is moving fast, white and green over the dark rocks, loud from here, very loud, the sound rising up through the planks of the bridge and into your hands and feet as much as your ears. There is something deeply grounding about standing on a bridge over fast water. The water does not care that you are there. It was here before you and it will be here after you, and it is doing what it has always done, which is move and move and move, never the same water twice, always itself. You watch it for a moment, then you move on. The path climbs in stages. There are sections of stone staircase, the steps cut directly into the rock face, or assembled from great flat slabs, worn to a gentle smoothness in the centre by a century of feet. There are perhaps 350 steps in total between the gorge entrance and the monastery above, but you do not count them. You simply walk, one step at a time, one breath at a time. The gorge walls press in as you go higher. At certain points they are close enough that you could reach out both arms and touch stone on either side, the rock cold and slightly rough against your fingers, furred at the edges with moss that is extraordinarily green in the dim light, an almost electric green, the kind of colour that seems to generate its own light from within. At other points, the walls pull back, and you find yourself in a wider section, a kind of chamber in the rock where the path levels briefly, and you can stand and breathe and look up at the thin strip of sky overhead, a pale blue sliver between the grey limestone walls, impossibly far above, the tops of a few trees just visible at the rim, leaning out over the edge as if looking down at you. You look up at the sky. You breathe. The mist drifts around you. There are waterfalls. Not one or two. Many. At every bend in the gorge, every narrowing of the channel, the water finds a new way to fall, a new ledge to break over, a new angle to descend. Some of them are long and white and very loud, ribbon falls that drop from a shelf of rock above and hit the pool below with a force you can feel in your chest. Some are smaller, almost gentle, a thin curtain of water sliding down the face of the rock into a shallow basin, the sound of them a high, clear note beneath the deeper roar of the main brook. At one point, the path passes so close to a fall that the spray reaches you, not a mist now, but actual drops, cold and distinct on your bare arms, on your face. You stop. You let it fall on you. The cold drops, the mineral smell of the water, the sound of it hitting the rock, the pool, your skin. You are very much in your body here, in a way that the rest of the day is not required. The coolness brings you into your senses. The sound fills your hearing completely. There is no room in your attention for anything else. Just this. The water falling. The cold. The green. The walls of the gorge are alive. That is the thing that stays with you as you climb. The fact that the rock, which seems at first hard and fixed and inert, is in fact covered in every crack and hollow and shelf with growing things. Ferns unfurl from crevices in the limestone, their fronds pale green and soft, curving downward under their own weight. Mosses coat every surface that holds moisture, deep and cushioned, a dozen shades of green from nearly yellow to nearly black. Liverworts spread in flat, dark lobes across the wetter sections of rock. Ancient plants, unchanged for 300 million years, simply being what they are in the cool, damp dark of the gorge. And in the wider sections, where a little more light falls, shrubs have taken hold in the thin soil above the path, and their leaves drip with the condensed moisture of the gorge air, and the sound of those drops on the leaves. Below them is one of the quieter sounds in the gorge, a small, domestic, patient sound, barely audible beneath the water noise, but there if you listen. You listen as you climb. You have stopped thinking, you realize. There is nothing to think about in here. The gorge has taken that responsibility from you, filling all your senses so completely that the thinking part of you is simply, quietly stepped aside. There are places on the path where the walkway has been bolted to the cliff face itself. A narrow metal platform, a meter wide or less, with a steel cable strung along the wall to hold. And the drop to the water below, directly beneath your feet. You hold the cable, not out of fear exactly, more out of habit, out of respect. The gorge is respectful of you, in its way, offering this path. close enough that you can see its grain, the individual layers of limestone deposited on an ancient sea floor over millions of quiet years, now exposed here, vertical by the patient work of the water below. You rest your free hand against the rock. It is cold and slightly rough, and very real. This is old, you think? Not old the way buildings are old, or old the way villages are old, but old the way the world is old, before human time, before animal time, before most of the things that currently exist on this planet existed at all. And the water below it is new. New this morning. New every moment. The same river it has always been, carrying different water every instant. Old rock, new water, you between them. The gorge begins to open. Gradually, almost imperceptibly, the walls pull back, the light increases, the sound of the water changes from the tight, amplified roar of the narrow sections to something slightly more diffuse, the sound of water in open air. The steps become less frequent, the path widens a little. The ferns are still there, but above them now you can see small trees, and above the tree a broader strip of sky, and in that sky, white cloud, moving slowly in what must be a breeze up there. Though down in the gorge you feel nothing but stillness. You climb the last set of steps. You come out of the gorge, and you stop, because above you, set into a sheer limestone cliff that rises perhaps 100 meters from the forest below, is the monastery of St. Gorgonberg. The monastery is extraordinary, not for its size, it is not large, but for its position, perched on a rocky outcrop on the cliff face, seemingly growing from the rock itself. The pale render of its walls, almost the same colour as the limestone, around it. Its small church tower rising above a terrace of old stone, from which you will discover the view is astonishing. This place has been a place of pilgrimage since at least the year 1138, when it was founded as a Benedictine monastery. Though the site itself is older than that, much older, going back to the middle of the 10th century, when a man named Ratold of Aibling chose this remote and difficult place as the location for his hermitage. He would have come up the same gorge you came up, the same water would have fallen on either side of him, the same cold rock walls, the same green. You think about that as you climb the last path to the monastery gate. Through the gate, everything changes. After the drama of the gorge, after the noise and the mist and the close stone walls, the monastery courtyard is a place of extraordinary quiet. The sound of the water is still there, but distant now. A soft underlayer to the silence. A few birds call somewhere in the forest below. The wind moves through the tops of the trees. You find the terrace. It is on the south side of the monastery, a wide open stone terrace that juts out over the valley below, and from it the view is suddenly completely open. The Inn Valley stretches out before you, wide and green and full of afternoon light, the farmsteads and villages small and peaceful below, the mountains rising on the far side, ridge after ridge in the blue distance, the furthest peaks softened by haze into something almost painted, something that seems to belong more to the sky than to the earth. You sit at one of the long wooden tables on the terrace. You rest your hands flat on the warm old wood. You have climbed 350 steps. You have walked through a kilometre of gorge, through the mist and the noise and the cool, and now you are here, in the sun, on a terrace that has been receiving pilgrims for 1,000 years, and the valley is below you, and the sky is above you, and there is nothing at all you need to do. The monastery serves food and drink on the terrace, and you accept something cold and simple, and you drink it slowly, looking out at the valley and the mountains beyond the valley and the sky above the mountains. There is a deep quietness here that is different from the quietness of the gorge. The gorge was quiet. The way fast water is quiet, an interior quiet beneath great noise, a stillness at the center of turbulence. This is an exterior quiet, an open quiet, a quiet of space and light and the long view. Both of them, you think, are necessary. The descent takes a different path, because the gorge is one way for safety, going up only. You return by the way of the cross, a broad path that winds down the southern face of the mountain through open woodland and high meadow, past a long series of carved stone shrines set into the hillside at intervals, each one marking a station of an ancient pilgrimage route, each one worn by weather and time into something gentle and soft-edged. The path is wide and easy after the gorge. Your feet find their own pace, and your attention, released from the careful step-by-step of the gorge path, opens outward. The light here is warm and full. Where the trees thin, you can see across to the far side of the valley, the fields down there catching the afternoon sun, a deep warm gold, the shadow of a cloud moving slowly across them, darkening a strip of hillside and then releasing it again. You walk slowly. The shrine stones stand quietly in the grass beside the path. The woodland birds move in the branches above you. The distant sound of the brook is below you somewhere, still running, still tumbling, finding its way back to the inn. You descend through a long, open meadow where the grass is long and pale in the late afternoon light, and the insects move in small clouds above the flower heads, and the whole hillside has the warm, drowsy quality of a summer afternoon that has been going on for a long time and shows no signs of ending. You are not thinking about very much. Your legs move, the path descends, the valley comes closer. Slowly. Stands is below you now, the church spire catching the last direct sunlight, the rooftops warm with it. You find the path back through the village, back past the old stone houses and their geraniums, past the church where the bell has already rung once today and is quiet now. The heat of the valley is here again, different after the coolness of the gorge. Heavier and more ordinary. A reminder that above you and behind you, there is a place where the world is different, cooler and greener and older and full of the sound of running water. The station is a short walk. You sit on the platform bench in the warm, late afternoon and wait for the train. And the mountains are around you on all sides, and the swifts are doing their sharp, fast work in the sky overhead, and somewhere far up in the trees, on the hillside, a woodpecker is working. A steady, patient rhythm. Wood and wood and wood. The train back to Innsbruck comes quietly. You find your seat by the window again. The Inn Valley unreels in reverse now, the same meadows and farmsteads and bends of river, but different in the late afternoon light, the long shadows of the western mountains. sun's already reaching across the valley floor, the light on the eastern slopes warm and low, everything amber and golden where it was white and blue this morning. You watch it go past. Your legs are pleasantly tired. Your skin still carries the memory of the gorge, the faint mineral smell, the coolness that sat in your clothes for an hour after you emerged. You are thinking about nothing in particular. The river moves beside the track. A heron stands in the shallows again, or perhaps a different heron, equally still, equally intent, watching the water with the same patient certainty. You watch the heron until the train takes you around a bend, and then you watch the mountains instead, the ones on the south side of the valley already going into deep shadow, their upper ridges still bright, the last light holding on there as if reluctant to leave. Innsbruck arrives slowly. The buildings begin, the valley narrows, the Nordkette appears above the northern rooftops, and it is different now than it was this morning. The evening light catching the upper faces in long horizontal streaks of gold and copper. The forested lower slopes already in shadow. The peaks above them brilliant. You step onto the platform. The station is warm, full of the day's accumulated heat, and around you people move with the easy purpose of a city at the end of its afternoon. But you look north. The Nordkette is right there, rising almost directly from the edge of the city, 2,000 meters of mountain above the rooftops, the peaks catching the last of the light, while everything below them darkens. You stand on the platform and look at it. You have been inside a mountain today, or as close as you could come without tools and determination. You have been between walls of stone, older than most things, breathing air, cooled by water that began as snow on a high ridge, listening to a sound that has no silence in it, only layers of other sounds, arranged by the gorge into something continuous and permanent and very beautiful. And now, here is the mountain again, the same range, more or less, the Karwendel, looking back at you from the far side of the valley, enormous and unhurried, and not particularly interested in what you did today. It was there before today. It will be there tomorrow. That is fine. You did not go there for the mountain's sake. You went there for yours. Later, much later, you are somewhere warm and still. The day has settled into you the way good days do, not as a list of things that happened, but as a quality of feeling, a residue. The coolness of the gorge is still with you somehow, even now, even here, in the warm room and the warm bed. A memory of cool air on your forearms, a memory of the sound of the brook in the narrow channel below. You close your eyes. Behind your eyes, the gorge arranges itself gently. The first bridge, the planks dark with moisture, the water moving fast below, white and green over the dark rocks. The moss on the limestone, extraordinarily green in the dim light, cushioned and quiet, not doing anything, simply being green. The mist from the waterfall, cold and fine on your face, your skin cool after the heat of the walk from the village. The thin strip of sky between the cliff tops, pale blue, impossibly far above. The tops of the trees leaning out over the edge, looking down. These things drift through, one after another, the way water moves over stones. Always flowing, never forcing, finding the easiest way. The The sound of the brook is still there, at the edge of hearing, or somewhere beneath hearing, or simply in the memory of hearing, which at this hour, in this stillness, is much the same thing. It has been running for longer than you can imagine. It will be running tomorrow. It was running when you were not there to hear it. It does not need you to hear it. It simply runs over the same stones, through the same narrow channel, between the same ancient walls, turning white where it breaks and green where it deepens, and moving, always moving, down toward the inn, and the inn toward the wider valley, and the valley toward everything else. You breathe in the cold mist on your face. You breathe out the sound of water in the dark. You breathe in the green of the moss on the old stone. You breathe out, and the ferns in the dim light, uncurling very slowly as they have always done, in the cool, damp air of the gorge where the water never stops, and the rock is very old, and the sky is a thin strip of blue a long way above. And now, as everything grows quieter, and the sound of the water softened to something almost imagined, and the cool of the gorge fades slowly from your skin, and your thoughts begin to soften at their edges, you can stay here, in the wolf's clam, between the old stone walls, or you can drift somewhere deeper still, knowing the brook is still running, knowing the mosses are still green in the dark, knowing the monastery is still there on its cliff, and the valley is quiet below it, and the Nordkett stands over Innsbruck in the late evening light, and everything is still, and there is nothing left to do, and nowhere else you need to go. Sleep well, the water is still running, and everything is quiet in the gorge tonight.